The Belvedere Apollo. When Anzio coughed him up in 1489, Apollo was dragging the bones of the sun across Europe. Here was the joke of prophecy. Those stone eyes really had seen through the fog of 2,000 years. They shelled the god from the pack that bore him, set his legs standing in Belvedere, the quiet grandeur of his gaze. Confused. His muscles the tension of a long-shot contrapposto, but the strophium still banded his head. Relieved, he settled and slept. The laurels would find new worship amongst poets. The artists would charge him, stuff him with the heady bluff of a Dharmic myth. America would shoot him to the stars.
Well, that was Gemma L. King reading from Shape of a Forest, reading there beautifully. And thank you very much, Gemma.
Okay.
We've got Gemma as a guest today, and as usual, the marvellous Matthew Jarvis will be helping me dissecting the latest that comes out of Welsh poetry.
Thanks, Dav. Great to be here again.
It's good to see you again, Matthew. Right then, we better jump into the next few items. We will be discussing this poetry collection with Gemma, and later on, Matthew, you've brought in a few collections from Seren.
They are a pamphlet first, Shadow Dispatches by Polly Atkin. And then there's a collection by Marianne Burton called She Inserts the Key, and one by Catherine Maris called God Loves You.
I'm looking forward to hearing what you have to say about
Matthew.
But anyway, we'll see you at the other side of this ditty. We'll be jumping straight into the latest poetry news from Wales. If you want to tweet us, we're at planet_TWI. Matthew, do you want to give out your Twitter?
At that Matt Jarvis.
Lovely. And Gemma, what are you? Do you even remember?
No.
I like that.
Yeah, that's
isn't
good,
that
isn't
nice?
It?
I couldn't give a stuff.
I do care. I just don't use it frequently enough to remember these things.
Oh my God. Mm. That's wonderful news. Let's get on to The Shape of a Forest. Gemma, thanks for coming in.
That's okay.
Are you a little bit nervous about sort of discussing a book in such an open forum as this?
Yeah, in a way. I find discussing the book an interesting process because it's not something that I would approach myself and think about really how these works come about. It's the process is almost invisible to me. So being questioned about it forces me to really reflect on, you know, how this happens.
Does it in some ways turn you into a reader of your own work?
Yeah, it does. Yeah.
Because you're a critic as well, aren't you? You're doing
a
PhD.
Am. Yeah, yeah. So I do. It does make me approach the page, you know, with my critical hat on more. As we were talking before we started recording this programme about Victor's Trap and the way that you'd interpreted it versus the way that I'd written it, you know. And I'd already looked at it and thought about what other people might see there in the poem. It really does provoke me to reflect on things.
That's always going to happen though, isn't it? That's the very central thesis of poetry, isn't it? It's scooping out a little bit of your brain, slapping it onto the pavement, and then seeing what other people make of it.
Yes, I mean, it's obviously difficult when something is written to want to keep ownership over how it's going to be interpreted. That's almost impossible. And a poem is, to a certain extent, what its readers construct it to be. And obviously, an author has a privileged position in that discussion in some ways. I don't buy the death of the author thesis. But there is an important sense in which readers write poems just as much as writers write poems.
When did you start formulating the shape of this collection, Gemma?
Well, some of the earliest poems in this collection, actually, they go right back to my early 20s. So it covers quite an expanse of time. So for me, I can see my progression as a writer and how my worldview has become more externalised as I've been writing it. But, you know, the chronology is obviously disturbed, so hopefully people can't see that. And, you know, it comes across as more of a mixed bag.
So you don't want people to see the mixed chronology, obviously, of your own experience.
Mm.
You'd prefer them somehow to accept them as a flowing train, if you would.
Oh, no, the opposite. You know, I don't want them to see the linear progression. So, you know, it's, they're purposely mixed up.
You mean the linear progression in the order you've written them?
Yeah.
You don't want people to see that particular order?
Mm. Yeah, the time-based chronology.
Okay.
Mm.
But for a second, I thought you were suggesting that maybe you were seeing technical ability that had developed over time with you, and that perhaps you didn't want people to see your development, therefore, within the work.
No, it's more to do with poetic focus, I think. When I was younger, you know, a lot of my poems tend to be more internalised and more confessional in tone. And I think I've become more politically aware in some ways, you know, a lot more aware of everything that's going on in the world. So everything became broadened, you know, the further I moved into the collection. So I didn't want it to feel too much like it was starting off from a very centripetally tight point, and, you know, it would have been too much of an obvious progression.
There are obviously a number of poems which are very much engaged with world events.
Mm.
Do you see that now as a central part of your poetic practice? Do you see that actually as an important part of general poetic practice?
I hadn't realised actually how many of them were based abroad of myself until the book came out and I started hearing other people's responses to it. And I think it is important, because I think you need to define yourself against external forces. I think if the work was too internalised, there's a point at which it becomes repetitive and perhaps the reader doesn't want to follow anymore. So I think it is important for a writer to have a wider scope.
I mean, you seem to be in poems like Water Music, Winter for the Robin, and Victor's Trap. You seem to reach towards an engagement with the non-human world as well. Do you see that as again a significant part of what drives the collection? Are you interested in eco-poetry, as it's been called?
No, not really. Those works, they're not the expression of any kind of theoretical framework. It's just what engages me. I'm very much, you know, I love nature. I live in a very rural location. I've always lived in rural locations. So to me, that's my church. That feels spiritual to me. So that's why I use a lot of the natural world, a lot of the non-human world. It just tends to be my experience.
Bit of an Emily Dickinson thing going on there.
Yeah.
I rather like the sort of the aspect of the non-human world. Mm. And if we take that away as well from physical things, you engage a lot with kind of superficial scientific ideas, with directly link with sort of development of chromosomes, and then you have an obvious obsession with the formation, rock formations. You look at sort of igneous and all other types of things. Where does that feed in if you're trying to separate, as Matthew says, perhaps the human experience from a physical and a non-physical one?
Well, this is one of those things that I was talking about earlier that I hadn't considered, obviously, when I was writing the collection. And now I'm looking back at it as a reader. I can see all of these tropes recurring, as you say, the rock formations, the chromosomes and atoms and, you know, all of that kind of stuff. And my own analysis is really, when I think about poetry, I think it's one step away from clear, direct communication between people. It's something that's much more personal. And it moves into, obviously, a metaphysical place. So when I'm constructing poems, I'm trying to think about how to get to the bare bones of something, how to scrape something down to, you know, its elements. It's just trying to really engage with something on, oh God, it sounds really pretentious, but on a really deep level, if you know what I mean. So to me, my mind often goes to those places, you know, the smallest components possible.
What is a deep level?
Oh, God, I don't even know.
Matthew, do you have a deep level?
No, never have. I like that you are starting to see tropes in your work after you've written it, after the book's come out.
Yeah.
That must have been kind of an interesting experience for you.
Yeah, it was. Someone said to me, you've mentioned clay about 4 different times, and I just had no idea I'd done that.
Igneous rock, absolutely.
Yeah. It's weird, isn't it?
unformed things which are waiting for formation.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. I never thought about that before.
Chromosomes as well.
Yeah, exactly.
Cornflakes as well. Cornflakes, pretty small. Cornflaking, you make a verb for us.
I do, yeah.
Matthew's a huge fan of verb creation.
Of course, and cornflakes.
The idea of the collection, when did you think that you might put something together? Because it's easy to write poetry, isn't it?
Mm.
But it's much more difficult to go, wait a sec, I think I've got a vessel here to carry these.
I don't know, it's probably about 3 years ago when I actually collated my work together. And I realised that, you know, I had quite a body of work actually. So not all of it was fantastic, obviously, but I decided that it might be a good idea to just send it out and see what kind of response I was going to get.
What kind of a response did you get?
Hugely positive. Yeah, it was good. I sent a lot of work out and a lot of it got accepted to be published in magazines and whatnot. And obviously I won the Terry Hetherington and then I had interest from publishers then. So yeah, it was fairly rapid actually.
In the acknowledgements you say, many thanks to the best editor a writer could wish to work with, Catherine Gray. I mean, that's a lovely acknowledgement. Can I ask you about the importance of the editor? Because, of course, we know in poetic history there are really important writer-editor relationships like Pound and Eliot and The Wasteland. So you seem to acknowledge something important about the editorial relationship here to do with this collection. Can you expand on that a little bit? Can you flesh that out?
Yeah, I think probably as my debut collection. And also only having recently emerged into the literary world of, you know, all that stuff. So I needed someone that was going to reassure me that this was good work, because I think it became not literally, but kind of a literary parental relationship, if you see what I mean. So that's why it was important. She was reassuring me every step of the way, you know, this is going to be a really good book, etc. So, you know, hence why she was important.
Because there's one name is on the front of a book of poems usually, but actually the process is more complex than that, isn't it?
Definitely.
So in this collection, it looks like there's a number of poems which suggest a kind of confessional autobiographical streak, and you have used the word confessional previously in this discussion. And I know that one of the great errors of poetry reading is to make a conflation between the poet and the speaking voice of the poem, and to assume they're one and the same, to assume there's an easy relationship. So what I was interested in, the extent to which there are confessional elements here, or to the extent to which you're, by contrast, mask-wearing, creating persona poems.
No, I don't think that there's much mask-wearing going on at all. I think it's quite transparent when it is a confessional poem within my body of work, because the ones that aren't a bit about me are obviously not about me. I'm not a tiger or Amelia Earhart, so.
But the I in your poems, the speaking I, when you refer to yourself as I, that is not an I that's a deliberately fictionalizing construct. You see that as a fairly transparent relationship with yourself.
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, also as a critic, when I've looked at other people's work, you know, that the idea of the construct of the narrator, I find that usually when you look into the writer's background, there are huge connections between their life, their biography and experiences, and the narrator, that they purport to not be them. I would doubt, you know, in many cases that there is much of a distance between writer and narrator.
Your PhD might be kind of significant in this. Who is it that you've been writing on?
Frieda Hughes. Yeah. yeah. Exactly. So there's very little distance between Frieda and her work, and she writes, you know, nakedly in that way.
Because when I read Shape of a Forest, I obviously knew that you lived in the wilds of of Corris, at the feet of Cader.
Yeah.
And it did, well, it informed me anyway. That's easy to say, of course. But it that feeling of, I don't want to call it isolation because you deal with it in such a warm way, but that feeling of your own positive output, your own positive situation up in the hills, and then your then break from that, jump on the bus, and then you're in Aberystwyth doing PhD.
Yeah.
Has that been helpful?
I think it is helpful, actually. It's quite surprising, the amount of poems or the germinations of poems that have started in notebooks on a bus journey. So actually, it can be helpful in that way.
That'll have the Tories' plans for HS2 in ruins, won't it, as well?
Not enough time to
absolutely nobody works. Nobody works
exactly
while travelling.
So we're wondering, what's next? You're a critic as well as a creative writer. A lot of people won't want to separate those two, and that's a pragmatic distinction for the purposes of a conversation. So is there more poetry on the way? Are you a fiction writer as well? Is there creative nonfiction to come? Are you planning on turning the PhD into a scholarly book?
Yeah, there are a couple of projects, in the pipeline, as they say.
Can you give us an insight? Willing to spill any secrets?
Yeah. Well, I had a really generous grant from Literature Wales at the start of the summer to write my second collection. So I've been focusing on that, and that's just about finished. And what it is, it started as a cache of Victorian nude photographs, so really antique photographs from the earliest days of photography, and so I'm using those, looking at them and trying to research these women's lives, and where it's not possible to actually find anything out about them, just trying to give them voice again, trying to, you know, really interact with the picture, see what it's saying to me.
Is the eye of the poet anywhere near that work?
Couldn't be for all of them. it's such a range, it really is. But yeah, I guess I'm in there quite a lot. Yeah.
That's an interesting distinction between your description of the process of the first collection, which sounds a great deal more piecemeal, and the second, which sounds much more overtly like a researched project.
It is. Yeah, this second one, it's more like a fusion of my academic experience with my creative experience. It really combined those two areas. And it's been good in a way. I've learned a lot. You know, I've been working much more rapidly, obviously, through this one, which is the main thing. So you can't always wait for the muse. You know, you've got to sort of jump on the material and get going with it. So it's been interesting.
Yes, writing as a discipline. I mean, the sense of one being inspired is perhaps a rather silly idea, because writing is as much about the process of getting it done. Simply sitting down and doing
exactly, and it's been a case of practicing what I preach to my students, you know, the good practice of writing every day that I didn't always do every day, and you know, that kind of thing. So it's taught me a lot.
No, it's fascinating. I don't think those two collections could be more markedly different, could they?
Well, it's going to be very interesting to see. I'm interested to see if there are stylistic developments too, because talking themes is one thing, but shifting styles is going to be an interesting prospect as well, if there is one. Do you have a publisher? Can you let on?
I can't say anything at the moment, I'm
can't
afraid.
Can't say anything in the world. We shall watch this space.
Can't. I don't understand this word, can't. I'll ring it out of someone somewhere, Matthew. Don't you worry.
And it's amongst friends. No one's going to be listening to this, Gemma. You can tell.
Well, thanks a lot for coming in, Gemma. Now then, you're going to be reading another poem for us now. Just a quick note. How do you feel when you perform your own poem? Is it something that you try and deliver in a, you know, in a prescripted way, or?
Yeah. I tend to read the ones that are less about me. Actually, interestingly, I tend to pick the ones that are much more externalised.
Yeah.
I was fascinated when you read Victor's Trap at the difference between the poem on the page and the poem to the ear, in your relationship with the line breaks, which wasn't necessarily reflected in how you spoke the poem. And I wondered if you had a distinct sense of these two things existing, of one poem existing quite clearly in two media.
Mm. No, I think I see them as very much meshed together. You know, that's just how I read it, and that's how I set it out on the page. That's my take on it, I guess. it's up to other people to negotiate how they feel about it.
That's fascinating. That is. That's the death of the author right there, Matthew.
Absolutely, very much. I suppose it is. Yes, I suppose I overstated that earlier, the death of the author. Well, there's a little... Obviously, it's the theoretical position does make a great deal of sense that the poem, once it's out there, is to be interpreted as a reader does.
If you hang around long enough, Gemma, you will catch Matthew out.
It happens all the time.
Thanks a lot for coming in, Gemma. It's been fascinating.
Okay. It's
yeah,
been
thank you very much.
Here.
Good to speak to you.
So you're going to lead us into our review section, and by the power of editing and the internet, you're going to read Victor's Trap. So silence, please, everybody. Silence, please.
If you can imagine a world emptied of sound, the softscape of falling snow and ceaseless morn drift, erasing all but the shape of a forest. Some white-furred god put his finger on time here, sent all but the bloodiest to sleep. His unbound breath collects in pockets of thickened white, dissolving, moving, airlifted and silent. Adds a foot to each fur hand, until the only sound, the toweled icefall, powdery impact, a branch hinge swinging, and nothing. And then a man. He carries spring-shouldered metal, a wolf-mouthed gape, waiting. The gift is placed, is one with the white cot of winter. It stands upwards, blank and ready. His hands are leather-packed flame saucers, setting a self-assured path through trees. Invisibility not required by one whose jaw-cutting claws and yellow-inch teeth make a friend of everything. He ambles his burrow, sends snow flying skywards under his 10 feet of density, and steps onto the 1 square foot of forest that holds fangs to match his own. The bone clamp sends the viper's kiss boring through his blackened lips, stripping trees in full tremble of their wares. He is a burst cable, dancing fire-footed, roaring at the pulse of caustic nerves, sinking, crying, rocks clumsied on his edge that can't take the weight. Rejecting himself, his mother's son now, the forest sold him. He colours the world red, his oak-chested shout thinning. The forest watches. Night falls. It falls.
Delightful. Thank you very much, Gemma. Well, let's move on then to that Seren collection you've brought in, Matthew. We're going to be discussing those now. Let's jump straight in, shall we? We'll have a look at Marianne Burton. She inserts the key. What did you think of that?
Shall we start with the cover?
Yes, go in. Yes, start at the start.
Because the book is, you know, the book is a whole thing. It's not just what's inside. I think Seren have done a great job with the cover. Seren are usually really good with their visuals. And here, great image. There's, if you haven't seen the book, there's lots of cogs coming out of the head of a bowed mosaic figure. And I like the way that it's been designed so that the colour of the title and the author name, picking out key colours in the visual, it's an encouraging thing. It's the sort of thing that if you see it from a distance on a shelf, you think, oh, yeah, yeah, I'm going to take a look at that.
Mm. No, it's lovely. It's I believe it's been shortlisted as well, yes?
Yeah, you're right. It's shortlisted for the 2013, the first collection prize of the Forward. And I think congratulations due to Seren. Again, they're really good on the prize list thing recently. I think they've got developed a real knack now for putting out fashionable poetry, smart, slick. Might not necessarily challenge the conventions, but they're really good at pushing out at this smart, slick poetry that's going to get places in competition culture.
It's got to be quality, though, as well, isn't it, in order to get the attention of some very high-profile judges?
Of course, yeah. I'm not using those notion of smart and slick in any way detrimentally.
No,
this is high-quality stuff.
Well, tell me a little bit about the poet, then. What was your feel for Marianne Burton as a first-time poet?
Extremely good as a first-time poet. This is an assured collection. Let's just turn up the first piece in the collection. It's called The Flowers, and this is really how you kick off a collection. Mm-hmm. It's tight, it's dark, it's sharp. The language is precise rendering. So she talks about flowers. They rise again, ripe and capricious. Mm. They seed in the mulch of our dead. If one is picked, I'm just picking out lines at random here a bit, but if one is picked, another drinks its sun. This is sharp, it's well done. There's no fuss here. This is how you begin a collection, drawing people in, making them realise what your skills are. And Marianne Burton, clearly, this is a poet. Make no mistake about it. This is a poet who can write.
Lovely. You seem impressed.
Yeah, I was actually. I mean, there are things which I wasn't entirely convinced about, but they were minor, to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the most impressive things about this collection is this driving idea that runs like a rope through the collection as a whole, which is called Meditations on the Hours. When there's a poem for each hour of the day, well, I think there's two midnights, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes for a really strong conceptual core to the collection as a whole. And I think some of them are very strong. There's one, 2 a.m. Islington Night Feed, which is a striking portrait of a mother breastfeeding her baby. And I think it's as evocative a piece of image fashioning as you could kind of hope to find. I think the first stanza is particularly good. My blue-skinned parasite, my warm-lipped fish, dovetailing back to being the one body we once were, snug-fitting, the other joinder, not lovers, but lovers, my breast, your mouth, the suckle rhythm of the two-beat blood. Now, that's a good line, The suckle rhythm of the two-beat blood. It's got rhythm itself, and it's sharp, it's focused.
Well, let's talk about that technique then. We've talked a bit about the poet. What about the collection? How does it hang?
Oh, well, with that central rope together, I think it hangs really, really well. It's the hours poems aren't all in one lump.
Mm-hmm.
They recur.
Mm-hmm.
So you get little groups of them. And it holds it together really well. There, as I say, there were some things that kind of bug me. I don't like curiosity poems. Curiosity poems... the sort of things that say, oh, I can tell you a strange little tale about a strange little thing. And my problem with these is I think the interest is almost always more in the curiosity than it is in the actual poem. It's kind of a post-Martian frisson of the strange, the quasi-surreal. But for me, it's just a kind of frisson of the, bite me, stop it. So there's one of these near the beginning called The Woman Who Turned to Soap. And these things, it may be personal. This may be a chip on my shoulder. Curiosity poems, I think they're kind of a weak link in a lot of contemporary poetry. But I don't want that to take away from this collection, which is really, really very strong. And clearly, this is someone who deserves to be on a prize list.
Well, let's move on to the next collection. Polly Atkin. She's done Shadow Dispatches.
Yeah, this is a pamphlet, we should say.
A pamphlet?
Yeah. So
Does that mark it out instantly?
Well, I mean, it is noticeably shorter. You're talking about something which is about half the length
mm-hmm.
of a full-length collection in this case. But unfortunately, I think the cover... This is a Seren volume, and Seren are usually bang on with their covers, but this is just a disappointment.
Well,
it's just a blue cover. It looks like it's been shot through a word processor, to be honest. And I think that's a shame.
Well, after the high praise for the She Inserts the Key cover... What's happened here?
I guess it's... I mean, pamphlets do tend to be produced under slightly different terms,
mm-hmm.
maybe slightly plainer terms. I don't know what the internal decision would be about something like this, but for me, it's a disappointment. There's nothing that's going to make me pick this off a shelf initially if I'm in a bookshop. It doesn't look desperately professional from the front cover.
Well, that's a shame. What about the poet? Do you know her work previously?
No, not at all. New to me.
Excellent.
I wasn't encouraged at the start. The initial poem is called This Book, and it's a droll poem about books. I'm happy to announce it begins, "This book is available. This book is available in many countries. All the source code that goes into making this book is available." I just wasn't particularly interested in this kind of... To me, it's meant to be funny. I didn't find it.
Is that a problem? Is that a problem with language?
It might be a problem with me that I have no sense of humour.
I hope not.
It's not so much a problem with language, I don't think. The language was okay. I thought it was just heavy-handed. But, you know, this is a collection that gets better as it goes on. The first few poems, there were a few things that I thought the language was a bit slack.
Mm-hmm.
So a poem called Worms... Line 3 talks about someone going through long, cool grass, still damp with dawn.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, well, you know, it's not exactly a cliche, but it's pretty worn language. Pretty worn language. But Worms itself is actually quite a successfully disturbing poem. I mean, don't get me wrong. The speaking character seems to find things living in her feet, worms living in her feet, and it's actually quite a disturbing sort of feel by the end.
Desperately unpleasant.
So it works, but I'm worried about the language at times.
You feel there's a glimpse there, though, of ability.
oh, there's no doubt about that, no doubt at all. So, for example, when we get to a poem like Wrecking, which is much further on in the collection, it's a poignant, delicate piece dealing with a speaker who's got a new partner who, the speaker of the poem says, I'm quoting here, didn't reckon on quite how careless my body could be. And I thought the scenario of the poem was moving, and the relatively spare, simple approach to the poetics worked well.
So from a standpoint of, you know, going from cover through to the back, there's some room here for some considerable development.
Yeah, I think so. This is a poet I would be interested enough to see where they're going.
Yeah,
well, I'll pick their next collection up, definitely.
Well, yeah, excellent. And maybe this is the scenario where the pamphlet does work best.
Maybe, yes, because, I mean, often poets have not need time to find their feet. And there's no reason why early collections should be the high point of a poet's career. Mm-hmm. And in fact, you'd be very worried if they were. And so there's enough here to make me think that Polly Atkin is a poet to watch out for in the future.
Excellent. Well, we'll move on to the third in the collection, if you don't mind. This one is Catherine Maris, God Loves You. Does God love her?
Well, this reader thinks she's wonderful. I think this is a fantastic collection. I want this collection on my shelves. This is the pick of the bunch here today. You know, when you've read a poetry collection, for me, what I think I'm after when you've read it is that something sticks in your mind. I mean, in a good way. Bad collections can stick in your mind too. But in a good way, God Loves You did that for me. I read it first about a month, 6 weeks ago, something like that. And its language and its concerns are still nagging away at me, and they didn't dissipate. And that, to me, seems a good thing.
Is this your introduction to Catherine Maris?
Yes, it is.
And you are deeply impressed.
I'm very impressed. I think the way that the language is quite non-poetic, traditionally non-poetic in some ways. It's so easy, it's so unfussy. I think we're often used to language in poetry that seems to reach towards elevation. And it's not that we're taught to assume that that's what it means to do poetry and only that. But I think that perhaps in Britain, at least, it does exist as a sort of default mode, and this is different. It's easy and fussy. It rolls at you like the sea. It's really good. I almost don't want to say too much about this collection, apart from you've got to go out and read this thing.
Yeah, but what kind of impression does it leave with you as a whole afterwards?
Well, it's an impression of someone who has a really good capacity to engage with language in fresh, striking ways. But also someone who's got really interesting cultural engagements. So this is someone who's trying to work through, amongst other things, Christian mythology and Christian language. Not from the point of, I don't know anything about her personal beliefs, but she's working out this mythology and this language through her poetry. So, for example, at the start of the second section, which is called God Loves You, there are three poems in a kind of pseudo-biblical style, and they're fascinating. She's a very good mimic.
Mm-hmm.
She's a very good mimic. She can do that language, and they're interesting. They sort of approach a kind of mythology, those three poems. Perhaps I could just read the first three stanzas from God Loves You.
Mm-hmm.
And when I say stanzas, they're sort of set out as verses in the Bible would be, so they're numbered. 1, God's image was in the mirror, and God's image was my grief, and lo, I knew I was not loved by him, and wept, and I knew shame. For though I was young, I was not young enough to weep in the face of the Lord who made me. 2, in sorrow I set out, I prayed that God might look on me in my search for signs of love in his great world. 3, the first sign was clear, the call from Tom, Tom who loves me not. When he spoke unto me, he said 3 times, I love you, and I knew it was he. For Tom is like God in sound and in grace, and that was a strong sign. This is someone who's not afraid to just write however she wants in some ways. I get the impression this is someone who says, oh, I'm just going to write how I want, and it's going to come out. It sounds, you know, it sounds. What's really impressive for me is it sounds unworked. It sounds so natural. I'm sure it's not. I'm sure she has worked incredibly hard at this language, but you don't see the joins.
Is that a matter of confidence?
I don't know, but it's certainly a matter of skill here. Skill, technique, and I suspect very hard work.
Well, did you see the interview on the website Wales Arts Review recently?
Yes, I did. That was interesting, wasn't it? There was one bit where what did the questioner ask?
I think the question was, let me just look my notes here. I'm a Christian, not one who gets offended for the sake of it. But will I be offended by the poems in this book? It's an intriguing question.
It is, actually. My reaction is, I don't really see how anyone would want to be, because this is a poet who is working through the ideas in her art through the language and mythology of Christianity. So she's, it's not a matter of belief one way or another. It's a matter of this is being worked through in a serious way. It's fascinating to me.
We're getting a strong sense of the poet coming through the work here. That seems to be something which these three collections have got with us. I mean, what's going to stay with you the most with this title here? Is it the poet or the poems?
Oh, the poems. Yeah, because I never want to conflate the poet and poems and the poet. I think that's a dangerous route, because as a reader, you just don't know enough about the poet to start assuming that the poems are some direct or unmediated reflection of a personality. So it's the poems. So, for example, a poem like Last Supper, it's a strong poem about a failing relationship, and it's cast within the metaphors of religion, demons rising again. Interestingly, they're almost entirely grammatically based line breaks.
Mm.
And of course, the contemporary fashion is not to have grammatically
That's
based
right.
line breaks.
To break it, perhaps we're coming full circle again.
Well, or whether this is just a sort of different technique, but there seems to be no fear in the techniques on display here. There's no fuss, there's no bother. It's not overwrought, it's not overworked, it's just done with, that's the best way I can put it, there's no fear.
Yeah, the verve is obviously quite entrancing.
Well, I think this is a cracking collection. I hope it gets a lot of attention, and I think kudos to Saren for putting this out. Because, as I say, Saren seemed to me very good at producing fashionable work and really, really good at that sort of thing. And I want to know if they've got what it takes to produce the work that starts setting the fashions. And that seems to be a different order and different level of things.
But back to Catherine Maris.
Yeah.
What's your impression as a whole?
That people should go out and read this book.
This is in your collection, isn't it? It's on your shelf.
It's on my shelf, yeah, absolutely.
Well, Matthew, thanks a lot for coming in. Thanks for your time and for your endeavours, as usual. Now then, we've got some podcasts upcoming. Of course, keep checking back, and we'll be sending out links to anybody who's interested. Like I said, if you'd like to know when the newest podcast is out, just link up to our Twitter. That's @planet_TWI, and you'll get all the latest stuff from us. Soon, we'll be looking at a Parthian collection. Matthew, are you looking forward to reading all those and giving your thoughts on what Parthian are doing?
Absolutely. I mean, Parthian are obviously a newer player in the game than Saren, although Parthian's now very well established.
Well, quite. I think Jenna will agree with that.
Yeah. They're obviously one of the key players in the Welsh publishing game. So anything that in poetry terms that comes out from them, fascinating. And I believe you've just handed me a collection of pamphlets from Rack Press, which we may get the chance to look at.
I adore Rack Press.
They produce some very beautifully made stuff, don't they?
You said a word during one of the collections there, unfussy. Such power with very little fuss. That's the kind of thing which sings for me.
Yes.
But it's a very personal thing, as always.
It is, yeah.
Well, thanks a lot. Again, thanks to all of you listeners for tuning in, and we've got Gemma King for one final little delight.
Astronomy. As captive as the dark is, anchored to the earth with pivotal force, the sky, a menagerie of squawking light. I am trapped in all of this space, nightly.